a podcast by two developmental psychologists, four developmental psychologists, and everyday folk with an interest in infant and child development. I am Candy LaPan.
And I am Dion Benton, and welcome to yet another episode of the It's Innate podcast. I think this is, what, episode 11?
I think we're on 12. Maybe? I think we might be on 12.
Oh, we're on 12. Yeah. I'm underselling ourselves. Yeah, we're on 12. Okay,
great. Big time. We've hit the big time.
Double digits.
Yeah, we, as always, have a really exciting show for today with a wonderful guest, Dr. Melta Musil, and I'm going to introduce her, and then we will get to hear a lot more about some of her great work. So Dr. Musil received her PhD in developmental psychology with a concentration in quantitative psych from UVA in 2021, and currently she's affiliated with a variety of different amazing institutions, Duke University and the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience, Cornell University, and she serves as an intern at Cornell's Sage School of Philosophy. And starting in fall 2021, she's going to be a postdoc at Duke University in the Department of Psych and Neuroscience. So her research generally focuses on the development of social cognition, morality, and especially when children become moral beings. She investigates how adult and children understand and enforce norms and the role of emotion and affect in moral decision making. She is an expert in a lot of different types of methodologies, including behavioral assessment, eye tracking, pupilometry, and network analysis. And she has articles ranging the gamut in a bunch of great journals, including Social Development, Brain and Behavior. So we're excited to have her on the show and talk about some of her awesome recent research. So welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Melta.
So excited to be here.
Was that a good enough and embarrassing feeling introduction? Just like, that's how I always feel whenever somebody introduces me.
Well, at least the video is not recorded, so I don't have to look a certain way.
Well, we typically record, actually, but this time I guess we forgot.
It's that experience of when people are singing happy birthday to you, but you're like, how do I respond? I'm receiving this song, but.
That was a fantastic introduction, and I think actually might hire you as my spokesperson. Like, that was great.
Should I go into PR? I mean, to be fair,
Or like, do it as a side hustle.
I completely stole it all from Meltem's website, so all thanks to her.
Well, you have Meltem to thank for her own introduction.
Well, welcome. We're really excited. And this episode is a little bit different than usual because instead of just jumping in and talking about research, we're going to talk about a really cool thing that Melton made. I should also say, I know Melton because we met when I was at UVA, and she's always been just like an awesome researcher, but also a great advocate for other students. And so this is like a perfect segue into this project that she created. So, Melton, tell us a little bit. This is called the Psych Research List. And tell me a little bit about what that is and how that came to be.
Yeah, so psychresearchlist.com, or on Twitter it's at psychresearchlist, is a website I've created where I put together various lists of paid internships, virtual grad school information sessions, resources for applying to graduate school, and other sorts of useful information for undergraduate students, grad students, and even some faculty members so they can distribute among each other. And it all came about several years ago after one of my undergraduate students and I went through this rabbit hole of trying to find her paid internships. And
not easy to come by.
No, it really is not. And quickly, I realized that there wasn't a one-stop shop for these types of information. It's all these one-off emails that come to some of the developmental psychology listservs, which are very useful, but a lot of the undergraduate students don't know about them, so they can't access it. And I found myself digging through my inbox, trying to find appropriate stuff for her. And then once we made that list, then I decided that why not share this on Twitter? And that was about, I guess, a couple of years ago. And a lot of people really liked it, shared it with their students, which made me realize maybe we're not the only ones dealing with this issue of not finding, especially paid positions, because the same is true for unpaid positions as well, but paid positions are really valuable for students who cannot afford to not be paid over the summer. They can't just fly to a different place or drive or anything and rent all out of pocket during non-school months.
Right. And that experience is becoming just like increasingly more and more important and expected if students especially want to go on to graduate school. So
Yes, if you want to get into a graduate school, you definitely need good recommendation letters, and those come from these dedicated hours of work that sometimes during the semester doesn't really give you that one face-to-face interaction with the professors or the lab mates, whereas a dedicated summer can be really, really important for undergraduate students. And I myself have applied for different types of internships and gone through those when I was an undergraduate student in Turkey, trying to find how do I get to US? How do I go to Germany? How do I convince my undergraduate institution to pay for these expenses, which is a whole different funny story.
we'll have to hear
But
that story.
I can get into that too. But it just made me really aware of a lot of these hidden, oh gosh, I'm blanking on the word.
Like hidden curriculum that we talk
Hidden
about.
curriculum, yes, hidden curriculum that most students don't really have access to. And few students who are really, really lucky, who have great advisors, who, not to say that people who, we all know that professors are very divided in terms of all their attention is divided because the university expects a lot from them. So it's really hard for them to also be in, try to keep track of these types of things.
And not every professor is going to, not every faculty member is going to be as well connected. So and I agree with you. I think it's probably less to do with how great the professor is and more to do with just how connected they are. And I say that speaking from personal experience. And so you're right that finding these paid internships and finding these paid programs is exceedingly difficult in the absence of in the absence of the list that you created or list like what you created. And so for me, I was fortunate enough to know people who knew people, right? But not everybody's in that position. And so to have this single list or the single repository to which people can turn, faculty, students, undergrads, grad students, is amazing. And in fact, it's so great, actually, didn't you? I think it was the recipient of like the 2021 Psych Improvement Commendation or something like this, I read.
Yes, Society for the Improvement of Psychological Science, SIPS commendation.
Yay. Very, very well deserved, that's for sure. Yeah, I mean, I had the same thing as a undergraduate student, even just like having a place, I feel like, to even learn about those things, because a lot of students, like especially first-gen students, that don't even know that things like that might exist or where to even start. It can be very intimidating. So it's like, I remember being an undergraduate student and I didn't know anything. I was completely clueless. I didn't The only reason I even got into research is because my former grad advisor was like, "Hey, do you want to do research with me?" And like, we could apply for this grant together. So we had like an undergraduate research grant program. And like, outside of that, I wouldn't have even known that those things exist or that they were important. So having all that information in one place is just super valuable, I'm sure. Dion, did you do as an undergrad, did you get a paid research position as an undergrad?
Yeah, so at the University of Arizona, which is where I got my undergrad degree, we had this program called UBERP. Well, that's what it's pronounced as. It's UBRP. It's Undergraduate in Biology Research Program. And it's sort of a misnomer because not everyone is going to be doing biology-based research. I wasn't doing that kind of research. But yeah, this was a paid program that was announced primarily through the Honors College, which I was in. But it wasn't heavily announced. And I just happened to get lucky to hear about it because I was in the program. And again, so this sort of goes back to the point, or to my point, which is that like this, and to Melton's point, which is that this kind of resource is valuable, extremely, extremely valuable. Which leads me actually to a question, Meltem. And the question I have is, well, how do you manage, given that you wear many different hats,
With
right?
all your
As
free time.
Candy, yeah, as Candy outlined, how do you manage to manage a list like that comprises multiple lists?
So I think part of it has been starting small-ish. So initially, I just made an Excel sheet or Google Excel sheet and shared that link on my personal website. And then next year, I started again personally collecting this information, sharing it on my website. And it was back at last November when during the elections, I was just so stressed out, as with everybody else, that I didn't know what to do with myself or my time, and I couldn't focus on work. So I sort of procrastinated towards this website. And I decided to make it a standalone website instead of my personal website, because it just feels, to me, it has always felt weird to share my personal website as a resource. It's very normal thing to do, but for me, what I dreamt of ultimately getting this resource to people is I want other organizations to be comfortable sharing this and not feel like they're advertising me as a person. If it's multimusel.com/resources, then I felt a little bit less comfortable sharing that, whereas psychresearches.com doesn't feel as personal to me, even though I'm the only one managing it. And yes, definitely. And so I just repurposed the Google Sheets I had and then started adding more as the time went on. And another thing I did was I tried to streamline it a bit by creating Google Forms to directly feed into the Google Sheets. So what I'm hoping in the next few years, as more people start using this from PI, from professors, that I'll have to do less and less with the website maintenance itself. And these days,
Could become more like psych jobs wiki type thing,
yes,
where it's more like self-sufficient.
definitely. And so far, over 17,000 people from 92 countries have used these resources.
But
And
who's counting?
I definitely check every single day to make sure, oh, 20 more people
Right.
visited.
Right. Technically, Google Analytics, I guess, would be counting,
Yeah,
right?
no,
Yes.
that's. Or whatever's running the counting
It's
scheme, right?
absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's. I'm sure that's like more people than will ever read any of the articles that we publish or any of the
So
talks that
true.
we give. You know, like it's such a valuable resource that you're providing to students, and even like you said, maybe some faculty as well. And I really also thought it was important how you focused on paid opportunities, and I think that that's something that we don't talk about that much within academia. There's a lot of unpaid labor, especially for undergraduate students, that goes on, that we expect them to basically work for free to get experience, quote unquote, which is obviously very inequitable and just sort of, I feel like, makes a lot of the disparities that we have even greater. So I really appreciated that you focused on those paid opportunities.
Yeah,
That and the
and
fact that I'll go ahead, Melton. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was gonna say that, and the fact that, like, yeah, some of these programs require students to, pay out of their pocket, right? Which is also inequitable, or can be inequitable. And so having these paid opportunities is very useful in that regard. And if there's anything that the pandemic has taught us, or at least that's taught me, that is that it's possible to do a lot of these things like interviews and these talks. In a very inexpensive way, right? Use Zoom and platforms like this. But nonetheless, this list that you've created, you've compiled, it's extremely useful in trying to level the playing field. And again, I speak from personal experience, being someone who didn't have a lot of financial means and financial resources. I would have loved to have access to a repository like this, you know, so.
Yeah, I like having grown up in Turkey and gone through the Turkish university system, I always knew that I wanted to do my PhD abroad. And I sort of knew based on my other professors who have done their PhDs abroad teaching in Turkey that I needed some sort of experience to not be labeled as another international student or just a random student from Middle East. So for me, these types of internships, especially paid internships, meant that I could benefit from the known names of these universities, these institutions to where I would do my internship at. And that way people would say, oh yeah, I don't know her university, but she did her internship with at this place with this person, so she must be okay. And funny thing is, sometimes I still get that, where people say like, oh, that's a really good background, like places you worked at. And it just goes to show how much a lot of academics care about
They
these
do.
names and
Brand
institutions.
recognition.
Yes. And for me,
Actually, there was some I was going to quickly mention. Speaking of brand, this is sort of off topic, but kind of on topic. I saw somewhere on Twitter someone made a comment about how this year's NSF SBE postdocs, like an overwhelming proportion of them, have gone to Harvard, former grad students, right? So, you know, if there's anything that sort of speaks to that point, it's precisely that.
oh yeah, I mean
Yeah.
it's I remember my first year applying for NSF and not getting it, and then I was like, well, let me look at the people that did get it, and it was just like Harvard, Brown, you know, like it's just like all the like
Yeah.
name brand schools. You know, there's very few like public institutions and things like that. And so yeah, I mean, I can imagine that it becomes important to feel, especially, I mean, I can't imagine also coming from like another country where you feel like that's probably even more so, you know, that people are definitely not going to know where you're coming from or recognize the name of your institution. So having these other options out there, so you probably had to do quite a bit of digging and work though to find these types
Yes.
of things.
So I had my headset on internships abroad, ideally paid internships, in my first year of undergrad. And I
So
had
you're
to work my way.
overachiever, first year of
Definitely.
undergrad. Melton is ready.
I was working in, at that time, my undergrad didn't have psych labs, so I was going to another university in Istanbul, but it was about an hour or so away by public transport. So I would work there to get experience. And I remember emailing the summer of my first year, Susan Carey at Harvard, to say, I want to apply to your internship next year. How can I be a better candidate? And I remember thinking about sending that email, and I had a professor tell me she's never going to respond to you. And to my luck, she did. And she told me, like, oh, you could take these types of classes, or this is the focus of the lab, so it's better if you know these things. And I spent my next year working in a psycholinguistics lab and doing other things to show that, like, I joined the debating club to show that I can speak and read and do things in English, just to prove that I could do all of these things. And to my luck, I got accepted to that internship program. And there came another challenge, because to do an internship at Harvard and US, you need to get a visa, you need to fly, you need to stay there, you need to eat. And they do offer a stipend, but this is not enough if you're doing international travel. So I had to convince the president of my undergrad.
Melton just
This
like
is where
went
it
to
gets
the she went to
crazy.
the president and was like, look, I need to do this internship at
So, sort of. I was one of the, so my cohort was one of the first psychology cohorts in my undergrad. And my university is also pretty young. At that time, it was only 5 or so years old, 4 or 5 years old. And so going into it, I knew that it would benefit not just me, but also my university, for me to be successful and be accepted to places. So I had a conversation with the my with the president of my university to say, hey, if you guys give me this much money, I can go there, live there, and they're going to give me some money. The Harvard will provide this much so that I can actually eat and survive. And in turn, you have something to advertise about because you don't have any other psych students to brag about or graduating yet. You just have first, second year students. So they agreed, and that also meant that I would go on these like TV channels to talk about like my university, and I love my undergrad. And next year I did the same thing for my Max Planck internship in Germany. I went back again. They agreed, so that was wonderful.
You
And
became
then I
this like
went.
little PR person for your institution. I love it.
Yes. And then I went back to them to say, hey, you guys have been giving me money for the past 2 years. Let's put a name to this. Let's call it a grant. I could put it on my CV. This would look good. So then they agreed. So it became undergraduate summer research grant, I think is what it's called. And then people after me have used it. So technically, I'm the first two consecutive winner slash creator
Like,
after the
look at
fact.
this. So not only are you just like advertising opportunity, you literally as a basically first year undergraduate student created this opportunity for students at your institution in the future. That's like amazing.
And those experiences have been so influential in the programs I've selected, the people I met there who have since become professors themselves. So it was an incredible experience, and that's why I wanted my undergrad student to experience some of these as well. Even though she's lovely, and it would be even better if she always stayed in the lab, but.
Yeah. Isn't that always the case? We'd love to keep them, but we need them to also
Yeah.
go and flourish and do other things.
That's extremely impressive, to say the least. The fact that, one, you were able to get a grant established at your university, at your undergrad university, but that you had the sort of foresight to, talk to the president and to come up with a compelling argument for why they should fund you. That's amazing. I couldn't imagine, like when I was an undergrad, I definitely wasn't like that.
I'm like trying to envision like sophomore Candy LePan trying to talk to the press. I was like, never in a million years. There's like not even.
I started those conversations in my first year, which is, and so my university had this a thing where if you had a GPA above 3.5, then you are eligible for international internships in banks. Because it was previously, it was all business school, like finance, econ programs at my undergrad. But I was the first psych student, so I said, that makes no sense for me. I want to do internships at psych labs. And I remember the first response that I got was, you need to meet the GPA cutoff first. Like bold of you to assume first semester you want to go abroad. But so I came back with a 4.0 and a
Of
grant and
course
just
you
like.
did, Malta.
Now, here's a question for you. Clearly, you've convinced me at least that you were an extremely motivated and talented undergrad, starting from the outset. But the question I guess I would have for you is if you can take us back a little bit and sort of, because clearly these are things you didn't just start thinking about. Like psych clearly wasn't something you had just started thinking about. So what actually got you into psychology in the first place?
For that, I'll take you all back to my senior year of high school. I was in Turkey. The way high schools operate is you decide a track for yourself. So you could be the science track, you could be Turkish math track, which like science track, it can be applied to like you could be a doctor, a dentist, like to then apply to those types of universities. And if you switch tracks, then you actually lose points. Kind of assume a good chunk of your SAT score is now gone because you switched your track that you selected in your 10th grade. So
Oh no.
I always thought I was going to be a doctor, so I was in the science track. And then last year of high school, I fainted a couple of times, and they took me to a doctor who misdiagnosed me with epilepsy. And apparently that doctor was a really, really horrible doctor and just prescribed me lots of medication, and I just slept for weeks. There's a good chunk of almost like several weeks to a month of my memory from that period missing, because all I did was I would sleep. My parents would like push my head up, give me the meds, I would go back to sleep, and after a while, and like a whole bunch of other types of stuff happened in between, but my high school said, "This isn't her. We would have known if Malcolm had these issues all these years," because I went to the same elementary school, middle school, high school. So my high school paid for a doctor's visit on my parents' behalf and took me to a doctor who said, "No, this is a misdiagnosis. She's good." But that meant that I had to miss the Turkish National University entrance exam. So it's kind of like SATs, but it only happens once a year. So you have to wait another year. In that meantime, I met a professor from Koç University. Her name is Bilge Selçuk, and she was the one who made me realize psychology had a lot of subfields, and it wasn't just clinical. And because up until then, I just thought of psychology equals therapy. And once I realized that, I completely changed my direction. And that entire like summer, I think I watched all of Paul Bloom's Intro to Psych class that was up
On YouTube,
on YouTube, yes. And I started prepping for applying to psych programs. And that meant that I sort of lost a year where I had to reprepare. And I went to a really, really good high school as a scholarship student. And so I watched half of my cohort go off to US to go to all these prestigious schools, and the half that stayed in Turkey went to really top schools. Meanwhile, I missed my exam, so I'm gonna study for another year, which was very sad. And I think that was one of the reasons why I sort of hit the ground running in college, because I just had enough of not being there. And it just took me a while to sort of realize that had I gone straight to college, maybe I wouldn't have been this dedicated, and I would have taken a lot longer to realize the types of things I wanted to do. But that 1 year of watching my peers having fun on Facebook, at least, like you see those pictures, and thinking, what am I doing with my life? What do I want to be? And then realizing, yes, I've always known I wanted to be an academic. What do I need to do? And that sort of pushed me in the direction of
Getting
just,
into psych and all the things that you
yes.
did. Wow, that's a very strenuous path that you took to get to where you were. But yeah, that totally, now I see why you were so as soon as you
I was
started,
so
ready to
bored
go.
the year before.
I can't imagine you doing nothing for a year.
Yeah, I'm the type of person who absolutely does not thrive if I'm bored. And so I can't imagine what I would be doing or not be doing, I guess, in the interim. So I'm glad it all worked out clearly. Yeah, the psych, I mean, this is all about the psych research list, and all of that, I guess, contributed to you creating this list that now, which is nice because now no one has to do necessarily what you had to do,
Yes.
right?
You're
You've
saving
consolidated all
everybody
this
time.
research.
And again, just to note for listeners that list, although we talked a lot about paid internships, it also has a lot of great information on graduate school, including like virtual sessions. And does it also have stuff about like Meltem about grad applications and
Yes, I have some resources So some of those are links to other people's personal websites or other types of websites. I have like curated a psychology Twitter. So if any undergraduates are interested in looking up some of these main societies in psychology on Twitter, I compiled another list of that, sort of dividing them by subtopic. And we also, or if anybody is interested in moral psychology, we also have a list of international moral psychologists. And Jim Everett and I have also started this, started to use this list for a seminar series. So every 3 weeks on Mondays, we get have moral psychologists from different countries give talks. And it's been pretty cool so far because, again, being an international student myself, I've always been bothered by how a lot of things are very American
US
specific,
centered.
US centered, from papers to reviewers to who gets to present where. And we just wanted to, Jim and I just wanted to open this up and make it a bit more accessible because one of the biggest issues is when you're asked to think of people to invite, you think of your friends. And it's always this circle of everybody thinks of their friends, but how are the other people outside of this group going to get to show themselves? And hopefully this list and will inspire other types of lists and it will make it more, make people, put people on more equal grounds.
How DEI of you.
Yes. It's really great. I think all the stuff that you're working on is just making a lot of things more inclusive and more equitable. And so, and what I am sure is often thankless, thank you for the work you're doing. I like literally like my personal time has been impacted by your creation of this list of where every so you know working at a very undergrad focused institution and like especially within psych, we just work with undergraduate students and. So it's every semester and every year, you know, mentoring all these individual students. And like I was doing this, you know, on my different listservs and I'd take things and I'd use like Trello and like organize and I'd share this with students all the time. And so now I'm just like, go to psych research list. And it saves so much time. So much appreciated.
Yeah, and then hopefully this will make people realize once these lists are compiled how few of them there are. And that's part of the reason, sadly, why it's not taking as much time as it should, is there aren't that many places who that offer these types of positions. And since making this list publicly accessible, apparently a lot of those positions are now getting hundreds of applications, which is good because now everybody can apply. But perhaps we also need hundreds of positions.
True that.
It's good because more people are applying, but the pot doesn't grow as a function of the size of the number of people applying, and so that's sort of the
Yeah.
downside, I would suppose, right?
But hopefully it will encourage more PIs and more institutions to
Right.
have things like this whenever they can. So yeah, it's awesome. So everybody check it out, psychresearchlist.com. And we appreciate it. It's really exciting.
All right, so what we are going to do is we're going to take a quick break. But when we get back, we are going to talk about Meltem's paper called Eliciting Forgiveness, which is now in Wires Cognitive Science, which we are excited to talk about. So, yeah.
Oh, God. Oh, please.
in this particular segment, we're going to talk about Meltem's really exciting paper that I'm fortunate was put on my radar called Eliciting Forgiveness. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to let Meltem sort of talk about what the paper is about. And we'll go from there. But I will say, as a disclaimer, no pun intended for those who've read the paper, this entire area is new to me. So I am a novice, and so a lot of my comments, please take with a grain of salt. I have literally no stake in this game, and also I'm quite novice, like I said.
So we'll preemptively forgive you for any faux pas. Like,
call it a prospective forgiveness.
Yes.
Yes, yes, yes.
So you're making these jokes, but for an entire, I think it was my third year, that this topic was almost my dissertation topic. So I researched it all the time, talked about it all the time. And as a result of that, a lot of the internal lab jokes surrounded these disclaimers. I don't mean to sound rude, but, and then they would look at me to say, that's your topic.
It's making my cheeks hurt. I'm laughing so much. I can just picture it. Like, that was me, but it was like, my topic was social comparison. So it was like, anytime somebody was compared, but it's like so true, right? I can imagine this would happen all the time.
Yeah. So what is this paper about? What is does you know, prospective eliciter mean? What does retrospective eliciter mean? Sort of give us some sort of idea of what's happening.
So this is a review paper me and my grad advisor, Amrisha Vaish, have been thinking about for many, many years. And as I said, it almost became our dissertation topic. So I did full background research on this. And the big question is, when we commit transgressions, how do we how are we forgiven, and what do we do to elicit this forgiveness to get us back to where we were? And one of the big ways that my former lab at UVA has looked at is looking at retrospective elicitors of forgiveness, so apologies, saying I'm sorry after someone does something wrong. And something that I've always thought about is, what about these prospective things we do? So maybe before saying a rude comment, people might say, I don't mean to be rude, but, and then say that rude comment. And that's actually a pretty well-known thing about racist and sexist comments, which I'm sure we'll talk about those too.
Oh, yes.
And I've always wondered, do these work? When do children do this? When do they begin to do doing this? And that's why I went down this rabbit hole of looking into this topic. And so this paper is a culmination of all that research and hours and hours of thinking and talking through these ideas, and from a forgiveness perspective, to see framed as a prospective eliciter of forgiveness that we call, one instance of this is disclaimers. So saying things like, I don't mean to be rude, but... So asking for forgiveness.
Or I didn't, I don't like Donald Trump, but, and I use it as a specific example because I was at a restaurant last night and the owner made the comment. He was like, you know, I don't like Donald Trump, but, as if to say, hey, I voted for him. Please forgive me for voting for him. But this is some of the reasons why.
I wanted to, before we even talk about the more depth of the content, and I have like tons of questions, and I thought this was a super great paper. I'm just like super interested in this as an area. But first, the first thing that caught my eye when I looked at this was that it had a visual abstract. Can you please tell me about this? And like, I thought this was the coolest. It looked like a comic. Was this a requirement? Yeah. Is this just for fun?
So it's, I think now I'm blanking whether it was required, but it may have been heavily suggested by the journal. And I wasn't sure how to put eliciting forgiveness in a graphical abstract, because we don't have, it's a review paper. We don't have data ourselves to show like cute kid photos doing like fun tasks. So I use Canva to make a chart that has two columns, prospective eliciters, retrospective. And I thought it might make it easier to just put the definitions there and
it
a
did.
Little like infographic-ish.
Yeah. I thought it
Right.
was really cool. I was curious if it was like a if it was a requirement or if it was just something cool you were doing, but I really liked it. It almost reminded me of I forget his name, Mike, who does the Better Poster, who came up with the Better Poster format, where you sort of have this big pictorial space where you can summarize the key takeaway of whatever the paper is. And I thought that was really cool just to have that in there. So I was just curious. That's really
And
neat.
while we're on that topic of showering Meltem with all this praise, I also will say that what I really liked about this paper is that it is very much a mechanism-oriented paper. This is interesting though, because when you actually do a control F, when you search for the term mechanism in the paper, the term only appears twice. But reading the paper and thinking about the topic of mechanisms of change all the time, what was again quite apparent to me was that this is very much a mechanism-oriented paper. And so for that, I'd like to personally congratulate you. And I really love reading papers that don't just discuss developmental timetables, that is when a certain ability emerges, but sort of goes a bit deeper to argue and to sort of elucidate those mechanisms, those change mechanisms. And so to give the listeners an example, she talks about how one way in which a transgressions can be forgiven is by expressing remorse, right? And the idea is that by expressing remorse, this indicates to the observer or to the person that you've transgressed that you're suffering as well. And what this it does in turn is it elicits forgiveness. That's very much a mechanism-oriented explanation. And these kinds of explanations are rife throughout the paper. And so, that was excellent. And so, yeah, I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah, I
Thank
mean.
you. We took a lot of that from my former advisor's theorizing, as well as a lot of the already existing literature on apologies. And so our primary mechanistic contribution, I guess, is adding these prospective elicitors, such as disclaimers, and then expanding how would these different evolutionary functions or general functions of these elicitors be impacted by not using elicitors, using only one type of the elicitor, or maybe even both. And
Well, before we get to that, I actually have a question about the remorse aspect. So, again, the mechanistic explanation you gave was fantastic, but it made me wonder, the explanation you gave is how remorse can elicit forgiveness. But my question is, how does the feeling of remorse emerge to begin with? Right? So you're starting off at a very specific point in the developmental timetable, developmental trajectory. But I, as someone who studies infants and who's fundamentally interested in the process by which infants, acquire knowledge and, acquire these capacities, I'm sort of very much interested in this case, how does remorse come to be to begin with? What are some ideas, some thoughts about how that feeling comes to be? And how early do you sort of see this kind of feeling in kids or in infants?
Yeah, and here will be my disclaimer that I'm not an apology researcher myself.
I forgive you.
There you go. Already
Yeah.
using all these
There's
strategies.
some evidence for your hypotheses, Malcolm. They work.
But yeah, so the remorse, like children start showing remorse and seeing other people's remorse pretty early on. One of the ways that they do this is like by looking at their responses to apologies, whether they apologize themselves, and so on. And more recently, actually, there's some work looking at physiological responses, not just verbal. But again, I'm not so well versed in the apology literature myself to be able to pull exact dates and times.
I have actually a little bit of background in this because my master's thesis was on the development of guilt. So I did a lot of work trying to figure out like when do children start to develop a sense of guilt when they transgress against another person, and So the Grazia Kochanska is a big researcher in that area, and she does a lot of work with like toddlers. So, I mean, they might be anywhere between like 1 to 2. So maybe some still considered infancy, but and she looks at mostly behavioral measures of guilt. So looking at so this is her task that she uses to assess guilt, which I also used in my lab. And this is why everybody always joked that I was also the one who always made kids upset and sad. So you give the child a toy. And as the researcher, you tell them like, oh, this is my favorite toy. It's the best toy ever. I love it. Would you like to play with it? And of course, this toy is actually rigged so that as soon as the child starts to handle it, it breaks. And then you code the child's behavioral responses. So we looked at things like eye gaze, if they sort of look down and look away, avoid eye gaze, hunching their shoulders, holding themselves, becoming really overly still or frozen. Those are some of the cues that we see. And she finds that like pretty early on, you know, anywhere between 18 months or so, and into around 2 years. Depending on the child, there's definitely individual differences where some kids like, they just don't care. And she uses that actually as an individual difference factor to predict different outcomes. So like kids that show evidence of early conscience, you know, tend to have better like behavioral outcomes later in preschool years versus those kids that really don't care if they broke your toy tend to have more disruptive behaviors and more problem behaviors later. And so I looked at similar things. Yeah. And older children as well, using the same type of methodology.
Okay. Well, that's good to know that this, that there's some research on this and that apparently it's early emerging.
Yeah. And I would say it's not necessarily always, I personally found, and I, this is totally anecdotal by the way, but like after reading like this type of work that you do, Meltem, I'm like, oh, I really want to go back and see like how many kids explicitly apologized, because I feel like most of them never did. And we did this with like 3 to 5 year olds and they definitely showed like lots of signs of feeling guilty, but I don't know, mostly they did what we called reparative attempts on the item itself. Yeah. So they tried to fix the toy. Right. Ours was like a dog and the head would fall off. So they'd try to like get the head back on the toy dog or whatever to give it back to you. But very few of them, I think, ever said they were sorry. So it made me really curious. I have to like go back and look at our data.
In my former lab, again, I didn't do the apology work, but my advisor and our former postdoc, Janine Ostenbrook, she has a few papers with Amrisha on forgiveness, and they would do very similar experiments where experimenters would rig these toys to break down or accidentally tear the child's picture. And these sound very harsh to non-developmental researchers.
Oh my God. They think they that make... you're like torturing kids, but like most of these kids could care less.
And it's very effective. I think they've mostly worked with 4 and 5 year olds in our lab. But you see children being upset and then characters ask for like apologize. And then you see like, oh, do you want to affiliate with this person or not?
Yeah. They don't like break down crying though, which is what everybody was, they're like, how many kids have you made cry? And I'm like, literally none, not a single child cried in the study ever. That's not that extreme. But yeah,
we always describe it, our studies in the lab as not, because I primarily study transgressions and sometimes families worry about that. So I always say we don't show them anything they wouldn't see or experience in a playground. So they might be looking at cartoon pictures of people hitting each other, but that's not really like nothing gore or nothing bad about them. And we're not promoting that behavior either.
We would say similar things because it's like, well, kids break stuff all the time. Like, you know, so they come in, they break it. And we still actually had a thing at the end where I'd say like, oh, I think I could fix it. And I'd leave the room and we had a replica that wasn't broken and bring it back in and make them feel better about it. But still, it's like, it's nothing they don't, doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But, so in this paper, what's cool is like, again, you're talking about forgiveness and this idea that, you know, we just always think about that as like forgiveness is after the fact, that we do something And then we ask for forgiveness afterwards. But then we also have...
Apologizing, you mean?
Yeah, apologizing after we've done something wrong. But then there's this flip side where we also have these cases where maybe we're prospectively eliciting forgiveness by saying mm-hmm. something before we do something that might be harmful, and to try and elicit forgiveness. And when I first started thinking about this, I was like, this is not the same thing. Like, I was like, there's no way this is the same thing. So I feel like you convinced me the more that I read the paper. And I know this is not just like your idea either. This is like other researchers' ideas about eliciting forgiveness. But it's like, do you think it's always the case that what people are doing when, say, they have a disclaimer is that they are trying to elicit forgiveness? Because one of my other thoughts was like, really what people are trying to do is to make you interpret what they're saying as mm-hmm. non-offensive, rather than saying, like, I'm about to say something that's going to offend you and forgive yeah. me before I say it. Instead, it's like, I'm going to say something and you're going to think it's offensive, but it's actually not. So don't get your feelings hurt. Don't get your, you know, underwear in a bunch.
Wasn't that one of the main points, though?
It is.
Forgiveness is a reputation saver. Like mechanism, kind of, or the perspective forgiveness.
Yeah, but still different. So not like I'm gonna say something rude, but I'm not a bad person. That would be managing mm-hmm. my reputation. Here, actually saying like, what I'm saying is not actually a rude thing to say. Like when people say, for example, I'm not racist, but blah blah blah. I almost feel like what they're trying to do is to say this comment is also not racist. You might interpret mm-hmm. it to mean that, but what I'm gonna say is just like a fact about the world or whatever it might be. Does this make sense?
So it does. So I've always thought of it in terms of they're hedging it. We do talk about this in the paper as well. So by saying I'm not a sexist, but you are, first of all, you're managing the other person's expectation about what is yet to come. So maybe something, like if I were to say, I will use my gender like as an example, because I don't feel comfortable talking about other genders the same way. But if I say women shouldn't do X, then you might just react really strongly to it. But if I say I'm not a sexist, but women shouldn't do X, maybe the first part of my sentence will make you think, okay, there's something to come, and then perhaps manage your expectations. And we do talk about, like, maybe this is a different mechanism for these big transgressions like racism, sexism, xenophobia, or maybe it works differently for minor transgressions. Like, I'm not a gossip, but have you seen that guy? And so on and so on. So that is definitely one way I think it works. But one nice thing about this paper, just to say some nice things about it, I guess. A lot of this, we don't have any data on it. So most of this paper is, we have good reasons to think it should function this way, but there's really not much on it. Not with kids, not with adults, not mixing prospective with retrospective altogether. So what I like about it is that any researcher can use these ideas and see it. Does it work that way? We think there's a good evolutionary reason or good other functional reasons why it should work that way, but it might as well be not the case. And it'll be interesting to see, perhaps it is like the way you're saying, or perhaps it's all of those things. And
yeah, I think it reads like the introduction to a 20 study paper. Like, you know, you just read it and the whole time you're like, yes. Oh, there's a study. Like, we could ask all of these different questions. There's so many good things that it sets up. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Here's a question that I would like maybe to hear your thoughts on, because it wasn't entirely clear what your stance was on this particular issue in the paper. Is, you know, what sorts of functions do retrospective and prospective apologies serve, and are they the same function? And could it be the case that some of the reasons why you're not seeing a lot of work on prospective elicitors of forgiveness is because of the fact that maybe prospective elicitors serve a completely different function. It could, maybe it has to do with the fact that, the actual construction itself, I'm not X, but is a complex construction, right? In fact, actually, you argue at the end of the paper that, one prediction you'd make is that disclaimers would emerge later. The use of disclaimers as a mechanism or as a tool for eliciting forgiveness, prospective forgiveness, is it emerges later, and you have a whole argument. You say that it has to do with social cognitive abilities, but I wonder if I agree with you that it probably would emerge later, but I think that maybe the reason why is because of just the construction, the syntactic construction itself. It seems like it's just difficult to grasp. I'm not X, but what does that actually mean to a 3-year-old, right? And are there ways of communicating sort of one's intent to disclaim in the absence of that complex, excuse me, that complex convoluted language? And if so, would they show the same developmental timetable, that is, prospective and retrospective? That's something I was thinking about in reading the paper.
That is a really good question, and it makes me think of variations in different languages, because this is one way things are constructed in English. So one interesting way to look at this would be to see how, not just cross-culturally, but cross-linguistically, how does this work out? I only, my native language is
Right,
Turkish,
because what
and
you would predict, right? Because what you would predict is if it in fact is not a linguistic thing, which I'm guessing it would be your argument, you would still see later emergence regardless of the construction type, right?
Yes. And I'm sure there are some languages where this flows a lot more easily than other languages. So for example, Turkish has this evidentiality marker to indicate what the source of information is, which helps sort of those types of sentence construction a lot easier for children, Turkish children, than maybe English children, American children. So it's something like that might be the case here too. But again, we once again face the same issue of
We don't know
I
yet.
don't we don't know yet.
That's
And that
okay.
was also why I couldn't make this my dissertation topic, despite really wanting it to, because then I would have to start with adults to see how do adults think about these things. And
Just because they do it one way doesn't mean that kids do it another way, and you have to learn to that,
Yes.
right?
We're just gonna ask you a bunch of questions, and it's okay that you don't have like data to back it up
Absolutely.
yet. We just wanna pick your brain about this topic. We know. You've done a great job in putting together the
Yeah,
like
no need to disclaim.
Yeah.
No need to disclaim
Here's
there
our theme.
about not having data.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's it's just such an interesting topic, and to hear your thoughts on it and based on, what scant literature you have so far is really cool. I mean, I just thought, like, I think also one of my first impressions in reading it was like, I just reflected on like my own life, and I think about any of those times that in those particular contexts when we talk about like sexism or racism and people are like, I'm not racist, but, and like my immediate response is an eye roll, and to be like, I'm not like, nothing you're about to say that's gonna follow that is gonna be anything that I'm gonna take seriously or listen to, versus the other types of things where it's like, you give some examples in performance context where it's like, I'm not really an expert on this topic, but here's my thought, or even things like maybe I'm really not trying to be mean, but here's some feedback or something like that. Those I think hit so differently, and this is probably, I'm sure, an adult thing because that's a much more complex context. But I would imagine that you would find something very different in looking at how.
That's a very good point. I hadn't considered
Yeah, I
that.
mean, like,
Very
as soon
good.
as I hear that,
So,
I'm not sexist, but I'm like, but yeah, you are. Just stop talking, like, and don't
which
say
actually flies in the face of what she was arguing in the paper, because she was
Yeah.
arguing in the paper that one solution, one way of interpreting that kind of construction is to not agree with the person,
Yeah.
right? You may not, you may absolve them
Sure.
of being the thing that they say they're not, but you just may not agree with them in what they say
And of
afterward,
course, I also
right?
will. My disclaimer is that this is also just my opinion. Other people maybe are much more forgiving in instances when people say, I'm not racist, but for me, that's my experience.
But
Well, to
definitely.
piggyback what, well, just one quick point, then I'll let you run the floor. I was going to quickly say it also might depend on not only what you're disclaiming, but also on the listener, right? On characteristics of the listener. Like, I'm a black male.
Sure.
Right? So I hear that crap all the time. I'm not racist, but like I think, oh, you're racist. You're about to say something racist. Like, so you're not gonna listen to anything you're gonna say.
Stop.
And it might well depend on the person's just qualities of the person, right? Anyway.
Yeah. So Amersha and I, we thought a lot about this, and because some of the earlier work on this topic comes from sociological research, where they specifically look at these. I'm not a racist, but that's actually the title of one of the papers by Dr. Benola Silva, if I'm remembering everything correctly. He talks about it as a new strategy that white people use to say racist statements or hedge what they're saying.
Absolve themselves of their racist statements.
So in one sense, I guess if we were to assume that person is actually not a racist but saying something that's questionable, one reason they might be saying I'm not a racist but or I'm not a sexist but while they're saying is to try to find common ground to see, I'm going to say something, are you going to agree with it? And if you do, then I might say more things. But if I don't know you that well, or maybe I do know you, but I still want to maintain this image of myself as a not racist person, maybe I will just test the waters a little bit. And those people might also really think that this is a strategy that works.
Oh, yeah.
And
I think that they do think that. I think that they are just wildly mistaken.
And I think that might differ on people's general, could be about political orientation.
Sure,
or
yeah.
Other types of things that how effective racist disclaimers are might be very different from how effective other types of disclaimers are. So that's why, especially towards the end of the paper, we try to distinguish these minor transgressions from major transgression disclaimers, because it could be functioning differently. And if you Google image search, I'm not a racist, but all you see are these memes and cartoons about there's one that's actually a butt that says I'm blanking on that right now, but there are a lot of stuff that make fun of that, that make fun of that phrase itself. So I think the phrase itself may have been, used so commonly in a very racist or sexist or xenophobic ways that are just no longer serves the same purpose. But I think that would be very interesting for researchers to look at to see, does this serve the same type of purpose? Do people from different ethnic backgrounds, so if you are saying something bad about Muslims to a Muslim person, are they actually, is this really eliciting forgiveness, or is it only helping them label what you're doing? So this is one potential way that some of the more major transgression disclaimers could potentially backfire, because you're also providing people a label. Instead of an ambiguous sentence, you're telling them, this could be construed in a racist way, I just don't want you to construe that way.
I wasn't thinking about that to begin with, but now you're saying that, so now,
you've
do I
primed
have
reason
to think that you are racist? Right, exactly. Right,
yeah.
It could backfire.
And I feel like, Melton, what you're talking about, too, with, the fact that there's memes and things like that, I think that, I know when I was reading your paper, and I don't know where it is now, but somewhere in there when you were talking about that in particular, I feel like one of the papers that was cited for that was, from 1975. And it's changed since 1975 and how people probably perceive that statement and, the way that it's become typified as, if you say this, you probably are a racist. It's you're probably a redneck if. You're probably a racist if you've ever said, but I'm not a racist, but. It's almost taken on a persona of how we interpret some of those things. So I would love to see newer research. And like you said, I
he would in Stokes, by the way. Hewitt and Stokes, 1975.
Yeah,
there you go. There you go. Yeah, I'd love to see what more recent perceptions of those particular types of disclaimers. That was a really interesting piece of it that I was curious about. So hopefully everyone's going to start thinking about this now and start doing all this research now that your paper's out. And
I was going to say, I think that the points you both are making about how these memes have somehow maybe satirized the claim or, you know, prime people to automatically think you are the thing that you say you're not. Like, this sort of, I think, is even more reason to look at prospective elicitors in the context of different frames.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Because, again, you have, you know, this confound, as it were, and the confound is the what you raised. But ultimately, I think Melton raises a good point. We need a lot of work on this topic, and so I think it's going to require not only looking at kids and seeing if they understand these constructions, but looking at alternative ways of disclaiming to avoid these kinds of confounds, right? Mm-hmm.
Definitely, and that's why we try to distinguish, even within minor transgressions, different types of disclaimers you can have. You can have disclaimers about your attitudes, your traits, your performance, and each of those things might be eliciting different levels of forgiveness or not eliciting forgiveness, depending on your age, depending on the social context. So it's a really open field, and we don't know that much about it, which again, I'm so sad I didn't get to do my dissertation on this topic, but...
I'm sure that you have many more years of your career, Meltem, to dig into this and do lots of research on this topic.
Are you planning actually on that topic? Are you planning on, are you following up on some of this stuff now?
Not yet. Once I start my postdoc officially and get those studies off the ground, I do at some point want to get back on this topic because I'm very interested, and it really ties into some of the things that I'm currently researching, like gossip. So, and it's one of the examples I use in the paper. So we don't want to be called gossips, yet gossip is pretty fun and we do gossip. And sometimes people use these, I don't like to gossip, but I'm not a gossip, but, and then say whatever they want to say. And that's actually how even this topic came about during our conversations with my grad advisor. I was telling her about how I would go to these events in Turkey. So Turkish housewives from like middle lower class, they get together in each other's houses every week, and all they do that day is eat, knit, and gossip. And they sometimes exchange gold or other types of things. So it's just, and it's called Day of Gold. And as a little kid, I would get dragged into these meetups, and you see people say all these things, like they're very actively gossiping, but they don't want to say they like gossip because gossip is a bad thing, and Islam does not like gossips, but they would say all these things like, I don't like gossip, but, and the entire day would be filled with these types of statements. So that was always one of the things that I've been curious about. Why are you saying this when you're actively gossiping? Like, the whole purpose of being here is bonding through gossip and food.
Like, this is the purpose we're here to do. Let's just like all
you're
admit
all
it.
Here to gossip. Like, why? Who are you? What are you hiding from? I think that was just one of my frustrations.
It almost sounds, though, too, Meltem, just one of the things I was thinking of is, like, and I used the word before, like, the phrase self-absolution. Like, outside of also eliciting forgiveness or managing my reputation with others, it's almost like cognitive dissonance that, like, I know this thing is bad and I don't think that it's a good thing to do or it's not a value that I hold, but I'm going to do it. So I'm going to, like, absolve myself first by saying, like, I'm not a gossip. This is just this one time. I'm just going to say this thing. And so I wonder how much these other, like, self-perceptions that maybe aren't even so much, it's like I say it out loud just to make myself feel better about doing it, like, if that's part of it, too. Especially for adults, I could see that.
Yeah, I've never thought of it that way, but it makes a lot of sense because you're trying to convince yourself.
I've certainly done that.
Yeah, it's literally like when I use examples of like cognitive dissonance of like, I really value recycling, but I like threw my recyclable cup in the trash today. And like, what do I'm like, oh, well,
but
I
don't have very much time.
Yeah, I was really busy, or I couldn't find a recycle. I didn't have time to go look for the recycle bin or whatever, where it's like, this is not really, nobody else cares if I'm recycling or not that day, my one little cup, but it's like some type of
self-forgiveness.
Yeah. Okay, needs to go into the next paper. Now we gotta take it even further. Now we need to forgive ourselves.
Right?
Yeah, that's really cool. I wonder if that's part of it. I
now I'm gonna be walking around my house just exclaiming to myself. Just offering myself disclaimers.
I do feel like it makes you feel a little bit better in some ways when you're like, just like reaffirming to yourself that like, this isn't who I am, but this one time
I'm
a healthy person, but I'll eat some ice cream right now. Like, it's okay.
And the same way when you're saying something bad about other people, like you're gossiping, or you're being rude, you want to make a rude comment about somebody else, you know you're going to do this and that thing is bad. So by saying that out loud, you're just letting the other person know, like, hey, what I'm going to say is pretty rude, but I'm not a rude person.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, hopefully I get away with it.
Yeah. I know, Dion also brought up this point as well of part of your mechanistic account of like a developmental mechanistic account, or predictions would be that these type of, prospective elicitors would require some more advanced, possibly advanced cognitive skills. So things like recognizing beforehand that even before I do this, I might be doing something that is bad, knowing that it might have some potential negative effect, and that like I also should do something to like beforehand to mitigate this.
Some inhibition.
Yeah, it's like halfway inhibitory control. Like,
yeah, because you're still saying that thing,
you're still doing that thing,
forcing yourself to issue that disclaimer, which is a kind of inhibition.
So you need to inhibit, maybe you're not just like saying things like as they come to your mind, but you're inhibiting yourself. Maybe that's a 2-second delay.
Like a delay of gratification. Like, I want to say this thing right now, but I'll put it off.
Yes. Yeah. And you just say, I don't mean to be rude, but, and now, end of delay of gratification, I can just be rude.
Yeah.
And so I
read that, and at first I was like, yep, that totally makes sense. And then I was like, but on the flip side as well, I'm always like devil's advocate in my own head. I'm like, but wouldn't like really advanced like regulatory abilities be to like not say the thing at all? Like,
it
do you
really
think
depends.
You'd find
so,
something like that?
It really depends on the context. So I definitely consider myself as a gossip researcher. So that's why a lot of my examples are from gossip. And if the reason to gossip is really strong, even though I might have the best inhibitory capacities, if the purpose of that gossip is going to bring us closer, share an important reputational information about somebody else, or perhaps even punish that other person by saying how they wronged somebody else or me. So those types of reasons might outweigh my own intention to not ruffle any feathers and just keep my mouth shut, that instead I might say, no, this is an information that needs to be shared, and that's why I'm going to share it. But maybe I should rephrase it in a way that doesn't make me the bad person.
Yeah. I think it's almost like there's another piece in this. So where you say like this requires those three things, it's like also it requires like recognizing that even though this thing might be a transgression, there's also something, there must be some sort of positive that could also possibly come out of it.
Or this thing is necessary to say.
Right.
So it requires evaluating the necessity of the statement itself and weighing quickly the pros and cons of saying that.
Yeah. Because, like, maybe that's also a big difference. Like, imagine there are cases where, like, there is no pro of saying whatever it is you're about to say. And then, like, you're maybe not, you know, that your social cognition in that case is not well adjusted or calibrated. Whereas in other cases, yeah, there is like a potential bent. That would be really interesting to see if you could contrive scenarios like that somehow, or look at scenarios like that where that's like the really off base is when like there's no positive coming out of you saying this. So you should definitely not say this thing at all. Whereas there's some potential for something good in other cases.
And I'm guessing you could even look at this with types of things politicians say, because they always have to be really careful, but then they also say some of the weirdest things that they shouldn't say. So looking at like how often they use these types of things to make sure that they are understood the right way, or maybe they're completely avoiding it for these also potential drawback reasons of like providing a label for the listeners and not being sure how it will be taken. So it would be interesting to see how us as like regular people who talk all the time, like do it, but also how public personas, I guess you guys, now that you have a podcast, think about the things you're saying in your podcast to make sure that it's understood the right way and it's not taken another way. And that might sometimes require hedging in some sense. And
yeah, for sure.
Perhaps one of it is disclaimers.
Mm-hmm. What's just something else that sort of to piggyback on what you're saying would be really interesting to look at. Of course, this would be an expensive project, but it would be interesting.
All of Dion's ideas are expensive. It's okay.
Right. Yeah. All right. You need a large grant. You might have to go. Yeah.
And then with that grant, you'll have paid internships.
Right. Exactly. You need to parlay first with the person who actually is going to give you the money. No, what I was going to say is what's really interesting too. What would be interesting is to examine to what extent a person or politicians, for example, vary in the extent to which they disclaim. Right, and the reason this might so they might disclaim more in some context and less in other contexts. And why might that be interesting? Well, that might be interesting because it might actually tell you something about whether or not the person is that thing.
Yeah.
Right. So if I'm disclaiming in some context that I'm not a racist, but in another context I don't disclaim and I just say racist things, well then this would actually point to the person's true racist intention, this person's true racist character. But if the person is disclaiming all over the place, well this might actually in fact indicate the person is what they are disclaiming, or they're sort of that they aren't racist, right?
Yeah.
And so it'd be sort of interesting to look at to what extent this varies as a function of context. I imagine that it probably would, right? I mean, that's the politician thing to do.
Yeah.
You speak to the audience.
And friendship too. Though I guess my mom's friends maybe never stop disclaiming, and it could just be a Turkish thing, but. Perhaps with like even stronger bonds of friendship, you need less and less because that person already knows you.
Sure.
So that one statement should not jeopardize your relationship.
Yeah. You know each other so well. Like I wouldn't feel like I needed to give a disclaimer to my partner that like, well, I'm not racist, but whatever, like that person would know me well enough to know that I am indeed not racist and I wouldn't feel like I need that, versus when people are not as close to you, you might feel more of a need to do that. Yeah. There's just like so many potential questions and contexts that come out of this.
You stumbled upon it well.
Yeah.
That's why if it were to me, I would just like have a full page of just like, it could be this question mark. It could be this question mark, but sadly, journals don't like that, I'm guessing. We didn't try it that way.
You have to have a research journal where you write down all these ideas and at some point either test them or give them to students as honors projects, dissertations. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm doing now, actually, because I have lots of ideas, too, for my topic, for my area. And so I'm always writing these things down because there's no way that I'm going to be able to study everything I would like to study, but it might be useful for someone else. Right?
Yeah.
I was interested, I know it's coming back to it again, but another thought that I had was about this piece of cognitive skills, because I'm really interested in like the intersection of like cognitive skills that underlie like social cognition.
Mm-hmm.
And in one part of that, talking about like how this self-regulation might be a little bit more related to prospective elicitors of forgiveness. And then I was thinking about like, maybe it's like different sort of subcomponents of regulation or inhibitory control, and thinking about like that is really beforehand and maybe even like somewhat linked to delay of gratification. Like I really want to say this thing, but I'm going to like put it off for a second first. Whereas, like, apologies actually reminded me more similarly to things like self-presentation after the fact. Like, now I did something wrong, and I recognize that, and I have to, like, present myself and, like, try to repair it in a particular way. Like,
and with apologies, you're often nudged to that direction by your parents, by your teachers, by your peers. Mm-hmm. People expect you to apologize. So part of it is a lot more scripted and perhaps even more socialized.
But ironically, as you mentioned, that sort of pressure sometimes makes people less likely to forgive you, right?
Yeah.
Because it wasn't, you didn't do it on your own volition, right? You were forced to do that.
And we do cite a paper by Marissa Drell and colleagues, includes Vikram Jaswal as well, where they had, I think it was their tower study, where they do transgressions, and then children, they either do public-facing apologies where other people see them apologize, or private apologies. And children accepted public facing apologies less. And that, again, goes to show we are also starting to be aware of why people might be apologizing, not just to repair this relationship with me specifically, but maybe with the rest of the group too. So before even needing to do that and deal with the hassle of apologizing, maybe pre-excusing just gives a clear-cut way of for ambiguous situations where you don't know how they will react, so you just use it. If it works, it's great. If it doesn't, you can always add on an apology and say, oh, I never meant it. I said I didn't mean it this way, and I'm so sorry. And in some sense, it might be even more effective than pure apologies.
Yeah. And it seems like there's always two sides to this as well that you're vacillating between and that you talk about, which is, like, again, always on the receiver's end and on the person who's creating. Mm-hmm. So it's like, how do we understand other people's elicitors of forgiveness, and how do we view them? And then also, like, when do we start to use those, or what do we think about them ourselves, and how those things maybe sometimes are the same, but other times are in conflict. And that, like, on one end, we're trying to manage our reputation when we're giving these. But then on the other end, like, other people also know that you're trying to manage your reputation. Like, when we get old enough to have that insight and understand that people self-present, that people can be, like, say things that they don't mean, and that they're trying to protect their reputation, then we maybe start to question. I really liked, again, some of those mechanistic accounts that you described throughout, where it's like how we reason about other people's elicitors and where that comes from and what underlies that, I thought was really great.
Yeah, and you see that on Twitter, social media all the time. These celebrities say all these sorts of wrong things, do all these sorts of wrong things, and then, like, screenshot that notes app where they apologize. And then if you read all the comments, it's pretty much people going through, they're just apologizing to apologize, to save face because they have a show coming up next. Or sometimes you do see really good instances of apologies where no excuses, no threats, I was wrong, here's why I was wrong, I won't do this. Obviously depends on the transgression as well, but, and it's just everywhere these types of transgressions and forgiveness strategies, because to various degrees, we always do something wrong. We always are in the wrong.
But... Not me, I'm perfect.
So, all right.
You know, speak for yourself. Yeah, don't speak for yourself.
I'm not perfect, but I do.
In a lot of ways, this is very similar to public acts of charity, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, there's a reason why some people are chastised when they publicly do things for other people. It's like, why are you doing that? Are you doing that for the person? Are you doing that because it's going to make you look good? And so there's some definitely parallels between a lot of what we're talking about here and closely related ideas and sort of actions. Mm-hmm. Again, like public acts of charity.
Yeah, and Irving Goffman's presentation of self in everyday life is one of my favorite books, where he talks a lot about, not specific to charity, but a lot of presentational things and we do and things we say. And that is also one of the reasons why I became interested in this topic. As I read that book, it was like instance after instance, all these things that we do and behave, we say and behave when we know we're being observed, when we know that our reputations, our relationships will all depend on the types of actions we perform. And again, like, what do we do to fix those things?
So,
and what do children do?
Interesting so Peter Singer, he's a philosopher. He actually has made the argument that public charity, I don't know about disclaimers, but public charity is actually a good thing. And the reason why it's a good thing is because it motivates people, right? If you see your favorite person giving money to, you know, a person without a home, or you see a person, you know, your favorite person contributing to some charity, you know, it should compel you, or it should, you know, it might compel others to do the same thing. And so, you know, maybe they are not, I'm seeing that there's a parallel, but maybe they actually aren't the same thing. But in any case,
well, it's I think it's different because, like, in that case, there is a common good. And in here, if, like, the common good is that people just, like, say they're sorry after they do crappy things to people and then, like, don't really mean it. I mean, it's maybe different if it's, like, if they do engage in reparation, like, maybe, then it's, like, oh, well, like, I said this terrible thing, so I'll, like, donate a bunch of money to this charity that has to do mm-hmm. with this whatever thing I did that was shitty, you know, and, like, apologize for it. But otherwise, I could see it being, like, I mean, it's true. It's, like, I think that we all have probably experienced something like that where you're, like, even in your person, it's like you're just saying sorry to say you're sorry. Like you're not really sorry, even though you're saying it. And then it's like, just because you think it's the norm, and so then it doesn't seem to be super beneficial if we just like.
Well, usually in those situations too, the person usually follows up the apology with some justification
for why they
did what they did in the first place. Mm. And I think that somehow, for me, that communicates to me that you weren't apologetic to begin with.
You
justify the act.
Nelson, was that in the
so
paper?
That's why no this... it's not it's excuses so
yeah
so
I'm sorry but
there was a time I had like I was calling disclaimers pre-excuses for a while, but then we decided to not use it because it's just another term. We don't need any new terms. You're just using excuses, and excuses work very differently than apologies, because you're not really showing that much of a remorse. You're just saying there was a reason why I did it. I sort of stand by what I did.
Face.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Saving face and doubling down.
Yeah. Well, since I know that all of our guests love this question, but since you are on a podcast called It's Innate, it's always time at some point for the question. Again, on this topic, there's sort of two sides. There's like one is like engaging in reparation or apology, and one is understanding, appreciating, and being receptive, or maybe caring even about getting an apology when something's done to you. And do you think that either of these things has some innate component, or do you think that it is something that we are socialized to over time and learn over time based on our social context? To just put you on the spot, you know.
I don't know if this would be a cop-out answer, and that will be my disclaimer. It's so hard to not give disclaimers when talking about disclaimers.
It really is.
That's a perfect example of a way of issuing a disclaimer in the absence of that typical construction.
Yeah.
There you go.
Ooh.
You didn't say if not, but, you know.
But I think it's, like, we have the capacity for it that has, over the course of evolution, has helped us make these connections. And obviously, a lot of these apologies and disclaimers that we talk about require language, require a pretty sophisticated levels of thinking to imagine what the other person is feeling, why they're feeling, how can I repair it. So a lot of it is definitely socialized, but the reason we feel the need to do some of those things are definitely a product of evolution and the mechanisms that it helps us survive as a big group, because if we just kept getting in fights and didn't repair those relationships, then you can't stay together as a group, and you have to find a way to not just punish the transgressors, but also maybe forgive them depending on their transgression. And keep the group together so you can fight other groups and survive as a society or as a team or group of friends.
Sure.
So
I don't think it's a cop out. I don't think it's a cop out answer, by the way. It's like certainly maybe the capacity.
It's a bit of both,
yeah, the capacity to have maybe like some of these important things we're talking about, these subcomponents or the precursors to trying to be forgiven or accept other people's forgiveness, like feeling empathy or over the process of evolution, these might be things that we have the capacity for, but that the more specifics, right? Like the language components, what an actual apology sounds like, looks like, all those other pieces do need, social construction over time. So no, I don't think that that's a cop-out answer at all.
and in fact, actually, I think your explanation, especially the evolution part of the explanation, is very much consistent with some stuff we've talked about on this podcast. And that Candy and I, have written about, right? Which is, there was a podcast where we were talking about Kylie Hamlin's those are clear instances of, or to us, to an adult's perspective, it's a clear instance of transgression, right? And we see that in the earliest case, three-month-olds, they choose one character, the pro-social character, over the antisocial one. And there she might argue that, this is because they have this evolved core system, moral sense, rather, right? That's evolved to ensure that we can establish these cooperative alliances, right? And so that absolutely is not a cop-out answer.
No.
In fact, I think lots of people would agree with what I don't personally agree, as you probably guessed, but that's an explanation, and I think it's an important one.
Well, I mean, I think it's actually interesting to think about this in the context of Kylie's work, because then I would say, so if I always choose the pro-social character, if I choose to affiliate only with pro-social entities, then you could make the argument that we have no capacity as infants for forgiveness because we are never choosing the one that has done wrong, but maybe it's because they haven't, exhibited some type of remorse, or I don't know, just, I could think about trying...
I can imagine those, little puppets just being, upset.
Yeah,
and, asking for forgiveness by shrinking, maybe, and, doing these, little womp-womp sounds.
Yeah, right? And even...
Maybe that should be a follow-up study.
Exactly. Well,
wait, that would be an interesting way of measuring sensitivity
would.
To remorse.
Yeah, that's what I was going to... I was going to ask if you could conceptualize of any ways that we might measure things like forgiveness in younger children. And, I guess I could see it in those contexts. In one way, though, I do see, I know this is not... These measures are not reliable in terms of looking time, but in those initial ones, Dion, you remember that she had at the end... That, the helper and hinderer then came, and approached each other, right? And, came together. And so that almost to me is, a symbol maybe of, a symbolic way to show forgiveness or, some type of remorse is, oh, well, I, hindered you before, but now, we're coming together and it's cool.
Oh, yeah. So you're referring to... So actually that little manipulation actually did use looking
back. Yeah, right.
And so what... And that's some work by Valerie Kohlmeier in 2003. And what they show there is that... When the climber approaches, literally after being transgressed, approaches the helper on some trials and the hinderer on other trials, the babies look, or at least 10-month-olds in that study, they look much longer, or 9-month-olds, they look much longer when the climber approaches
the hinderer. Yeah. And they describe it as a violation of expectations that, why
exactly,
would you, this person hindered you, why would you go up to them? So they're, surprised by that, but... maybe they're just very interested in forgiveness and they love that display. Not to be too out there, but it's be pretty cool to see some other types of manipulations to try and get at some of that and see if there are younger kiddos that recognize or have some sort of perspective on forgiveness.
Yeah, it's one of those things where talking kids are better. You need to have them say why they're doing things. And otherwise, it's just really difficult to fully understand what is exactly making them do that.
You need a thousand controls
yes.
Rule out all sorts of low-level explanations.
Yes,
for sure.
Yep.
Well, this is super exciting, Meltem. I think you put together such an awesome paper that's going to lead to a lot more research in this area and just helping us to understand this because you've done such a good job in setting up many of these questions And I just really commend you on that. I think it's really awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for, you know, indulging us for, it looks like, an hour and 44 minutes.
Yeah, I know. Now. We'll keep talking your ear off if we keep you here any longer. So, well, thank you so much. And Dion, do you have any last remaining questions?
Last disclaimers?
No disclaimers, no questions. I think we've covered everything, and I'm like Candy was saying, I'm looking forward to seeing the work that you mm-hmm. do on this yeah. topic and the work that comes out on this topic. And actually, you've given me some more fodder for my developmental psych course.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't actually have a section on this topic, and so I Agreed. Think I might, you know, include some of this mm-hmm. When I talk about social cognition. So yeah, thanks for that
too. Same.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was very fun.
Yeah, thank you, Meltem, and to everybody, we'll see you on the next episode.